Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on the Dialogue with Dewa De Boer and William McGimsey on Reality Check Radio. And this is the final weekly roundup, at least for Friday. I think we may end up having to rename this segment because the Dialogue will be shifting to Monday as of next week. And we haven't fully decided if we're going to be renaming the segment or changing what we're doing here. At least on Monday, I'll have something different for you guys. I'm going to be doing a roundtable with some of the Right Minds crew, I hope, if we sort that out. But this week, it is the weekly roundup. And William joins me as always. So thank you very much for having done all of these Friday weekly roundups with me in the last few months. And it's been a great segment to do, I think.
Thanks very much, Dewa. I mean, it's been a great pleasure to do them.
Hopefully they will continue. So international news first up and quite a few developments around the world. And I've already covered this on the show, but I'm going to let you give your opinion on the local elections in Germany recently. Two small victories for the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, and they've got about 30, 33%, 32% in a few states in East Germany now, and they will probably get a few more in future local elections. But they're still polling at about 20-something percent at the national level, and that election is going to be at the end of next year. And in case somebody's listening to the replay of this show, go and listen to the replay of the interview that I did with Peter Boehringer, although I think the Americans pronounce it slightly differently, so I had some trouble with his name, sorry, because getting the German pronunciation in English is always very, very difficult. So what were your thoughts on how the AfD did and how you think they're going to succeed in German elections going forward?
Well, this continues the macro level trend of anti-immigration, populist, nationalist parties improving their electoral performance. So that trend continues, as does the trend of those type of parties tending to do better in former communist areas, which is an interesting phenomenon. And I'm not quite sure I understand why they do better in those areas, but that seems to be a pretty consistent trend across most of Europe as well. As to how effective they will be in the short run, I think probably a limited effectiveness in a policy sense in the short run, given that all the other parties have agreed to team up against them and not work with them. And even if they did have some ability to get something done, this is still at a state level in Germany, so it's quite a limited ability to get anything done. But nevertheless, it continues the positive trend. So that would be my analysis of that.
And then over in Brazil, we had the banning of Elon Musk's social media platform, X, formerly known as Twitter. And there seemed to be a long-running dispute with the Supreme Court of Brazil, and they finally upheld this decision to completely block access to the app, I think, in particular across the country, at least to have it removed from the app stores. I know that some people in Brazil, so they could still access it, you know, via their usual browsers and ISPs. Other people have switched to VPNs. And there were even threats from the courts to ban VPN apps, but they ended up backtracking on this. It was initially going to be like a $10,000 a day fine for using a VPN to access X. And they even went so far as to block the bank accounts of SpaceX, which is running Starlink and providing internet in the country, which is a completely different business and unrelated. So very vindictive. Elon Musk has said that he will continue providing the service for free because he's still allowed to provide that service. He's just not allowed to take payment for it. And these are massive, wide-scale, draconian bans by the Brazilian Supreme Court on Elon Musk's social media platform. And you know, massive implications here for freedom of speech, because basically the ban was put in place after Elon Musk refused to censor certain right-wing Twitter accounts.
Yeah, so it's an interesting dynamic going on with these sort of free speech wars and Elon Musk perhaps the leading figure among other social media tycoons and other sorts of people fighting for free speech in these countries. So similar things are happening in the UK. We've got Pavel Durov being arrested in France. There's a whole bunch of these free speech battles going on, and it puts nationalists in an interesting position, because although nationalists are suppressed within countries, there's sort of this idea of the nation state being able to resist the imposition of free speech from outside, from a global tech baron, a global tech platform. And that's what's happening. You've got this global tech baron, Elon Musk, going to war against anti-free speech provisions in all these different countries, in the UK and Brazil and elsewhere as well. In Australia, recently, he was doing stuff like that. And so as a nationalist, as someone who believes in a national sovereignty and the right of nations and peoples to set their own rules, this puts you in an interesting bind. Nationalists are being suppressed by their own governments, yet there's this sort of kind of globalist figure promoting free speech and going against the governments. So, I mean, I think it's a good thing. I support what Elon Musk is doing, but it's sort of an interesting twist-up situation he's putting you in when you think about how you're going to support it.
I would look at it from a perspective of the free flow of information, that is sort of at least a fundamental right, as it were, or something that should be outside the realm and the sphere of what a national government ought to control, which is simply the free flow of information, the ability for people to express ideas and discuss political opinions, basically that a national government shouldn't be suppressing political speech. So yeah, having that fight at a global level to me is not so scary, in the sense of that I think it sort of violates nationalist principles in any way, or violates national sovereignty in any way, if you're defending something fundamental like being able to access information.
Yeah, well, of course I agree, but I still think it's sort of an unusual and a kind of semi-ironic dynamic where the nationalists are on the side of the global tycoon who's undermining the national governments.
Well, it was interesting. It's interesting you say this because Peter from the AFD, who I was talking to previously, was saying as well that he sort of likes a certain aspect of globalism in terms of free trade and so on. So there's many nationalists who support elements of course, the global world and things like global internet and being able to trade and access both goods and information in any part of the world. Many nationalists are certainly very, very fond of those things.
Yeah, well, and I would be one of them, yeah. But yeah, what else can we say about Brazil?
Well, what happened there, obviously with their election, was that you had Jair Bolsonaro. He was defeated in a, should we say, slightly suspicious election. And then you had basically a communist who had criminal convictions get back into power. And then the Supreme Court start to investigate political opponents. Everyone's heard the story before. And once it's investigated those political opponents, it tries to ban them from accessing popular social media platforms, tries to restrict the way that these right-wing figures can communicate and organize. And they're trying to do this in advance of the upcoming local elections, I believe, in Brazil, in the hope that they can, I guess, stop any kind of surge of counter-revolutionary groups and forces. So that's at least how I would sort of analyze the political situation in Brazil as being.
There are allegations that this Supreme Court judge that Elon Musk is in this feud against, that he was involved in decisions to suppress various bits of information and engage in other sorts of activity that had the effect of kind of rigging the election against Bolsonaro. So I think that's part of the allegations. And there's interesting echoes there of what's happening in Brazil with, of course, what happened with Trump in 2020. Where there was a big bust up over rigging the election, and who was rigging it? Was one side rigging it? Was the other side rigging it? Yeah, who's really committing treason? Who's taking over the government? Is it one side or the other side? And everyone's accusing everyone else of doing the same thing. It's an institutional breakdown. It's a narrative breakdown where the society is polarized politically.
And in South America, this is actually quite common to have revolutions, counter-revolutions, coups, counter-coups, military juntas. They tend to have one election and then a sort of a decay into all kinds of corruption. So what's most interesting about it is now that it looks like it's paralleling something that's happened in America recently, whereas previously you would have said, oh, yes, that's just South America. Now we're talking about it like, oh, yeah, this is the kind of stuff that's happening in America. It's the kind of stuff that's maybe happening in the UK or New Zealand or whatever. People start to compare it to here, which more tells me that the Western world almost is suffering from the same problems that South America has been suffering from a long time. Those problems are kind of worming their way into our political systems, where there's a complete breakdown of political structures, of trust between or any kind of cohesion and unity in society, where you have two different sides with nothing in common, and everything is always at stake. And so every election or lack of election is the end of the world. And you know, in the South American case, it often involves violence. It hasn't got to that point in Brazil at the moment, so perhaps things will go well. Perhaps they'll have their next elections that take place in a free way. But unfortunately for South America, that's not the trend.
Yeah, and I can't help but notice that the things in the Western world, the institutions, the governmental forms, the social cohesion, has begun to resemble the places where the large amounts of immigrants are coming from, which is something I think that is to be expected. Your people ultimately what your country is going to resemble. The people tend to, over time, influence the shape of the laws and institutions and customs and the dynamics and the politics that happen in the country.
And speaking of institutions, we could move very briefly to the United Kingdom as well. There has been move by some universities to remove references to Anglo-Saxons. So there was a little bit of an uproar this week online. Thankfully, I guess the social media was the only place that you would have heard about it if you'd been paying attention. I doubt you would have heard this anywhere on the news. I'm sure this was discussed by Paul Brennan on Breakfast earlier on in the week as well. But you had the University of Nottingham remove the term Anglo-Saxon from their module titles and saying that they were working to decolonize the curriculum, and that they claimed that they were also going to remove or were reviewing the use of the term Viking in Viking studies, because they said that Anglo-Saxon and Viking were both terms that were being used by right-wing extremists. And so they wanted to completely remove those terms because they didn't think that any kind of ethnic identity should be available to people who are Anglo-Saxon or Viking descent.
This is very unusual, isn't it? I mean, you can understand things like this happening in places like America a bit more, where it's, you know, there's always been non-white parts of the population. But Britain is a white country. It's as white can be. And they are Anglo-Saxons. It's the home of the Anglo-Saxon people. And what they're really trying to do is to delegitimize the idea of Britain or the UK being a white country, being the home of Anglo-Saxon people. And they're trying to make out that it's sort of always been multicultural. You hear these stories popping up in the UK all the time about how there have been black people in Britain since the Roman Empire. And I don't know if you remember Cheddar Man, the big...
No, I don't.
Well, they found this. So Cheddar Man, they
you
found
look like
this,
cheese.
No. They found this ancient skeleton of the ancient human, sort of a Stone Age type human. I can't remember from exactly what historical period. And they did some sort of DNA analysis and came to the conclusion that the skin of the Cheddar Man was a slightly darker color, not really black, but sort of a darker shade than you or I, from this indigenous Stone Age Britain person. And that's because the original hunter-gatherer people, this is prior to like the European colonization where the Anglo-Saxon people and these various other European peoples came over. So the original Stone Age inhabitants of Britain had this very slightly darker shade of skin. And from that, they've concluded, well, as I said, there's always been black people in Britain, you know. They're trying to do this in a number of areas all the time. They're trying to delegitimize the idea of Britain being a white country and Britain being the home of English people and Anglo-Saxons. And this Nottingham University thing is just the latest move. It's really a sort of ethnic erasure. It's a way of denying people their ethnic identity. And this is how Orwell told us that tyrants do things. They take away the words that you can use to refer to certain concepts. So you can't say the concept. And then eventually, if you don't have the right words, you can't even think the concept anymore because you don't have the right descriptors to use to call it to attention. And we see a similar thing happening in other parts of the world too. There's a move to deny white people, and in this case, Anglo-Saxons, various European ethnicities, to deny them their identity. And if we look at the way a term, just to move back to New Zealand and draw a parallel, if we look at the way that the term New Zealander, right, has typically been used, you know, let's say 20 years ago, if you were overseas and you were talking to someone and you said, well, I'm a New Zealander, they understood that a New Zealander was a white person, a British immigrant.
An Anglo-Celtic person.
That's right. Unless you were a Maori, of course. And similarly for an Australian as well. But with the mass immigration that's coming in now, those terms are losing that meaning. So our identity is effectively being erased in a way. What is it a New Zealander now? Is a New Zealander an Anglo-Celtic person, as you've said there, or is a New Zealander just anyone who happens to be residing in New Zealand at the moment? The great movement of people is actually changing the definition, the ethnic identifier we're using for ourselves. And that's a form of ethnic erasure as well.
Some of the reading I've been doing from early New Zealand history is the origin of the term New Zealander actually used to refer to the Maori people back in the early 1800s. Before Maori was really a word that people used to identify the Maori. Kind of had to learn their language first and figure out how they refer to themselves. But before then, they were just referred to as New Zealanders in that way. And obviously, very quickly, you had that shift then after settlers came. The Maori became known as the Maori, which is, you know, the proper ethnic term for them. And they wanted to be referred to in that way. And of course, New Zealanders shifted to the settlers. The Anglo-Celts who came to settle New Zealand were known as the New Zealanders. And as you mentioned, obviously, that can shift. But the question is, is it being done deliberately? Are people happy about it? Sometimes these things can be done through the use of force. They can be done through deception. But I think in a democratic country, people should have a little bit of a say and be allowed to discuss these things and have an input in them and actually be able to, you know, affect policy rather than just have it be completely shut down and say, no, you're not allowed to talk about this. We're going to make it impossible for you to figure this out or to use a term the way that you want to use it. And actually saw a story from the British Australian community who were asking for a question on ethnicity to be added back to their census. We've talked about this like a month ago, I think here as well, or 2 months ago, around the census in New Zealand as well, where there's no real, they basically fudge the numbers. They have a question of what ethnicity you identify as, but the numbers are, the labels are not particularly accurate, or they allow it to be collected in such a way that it's not very helpful. And it sounds like Australia basically has that same problem as well, that they're deliberately trying to hide certain data because it might raise questions that, you know, the ruling elites are not comfortable answering.
Yeah, and it's again a similar pattern to what we're seeing elsewhere. There's a desire on the part of many governments to remove the ability of the, you know, the traditional majority white population to have an ethnic identifier, to have a word to refer to themselves as a distinct ethnicity. The reasons they've given in Australia for removing the ethnic question from the census is, first of all, it confuses people because there's also a question about ancestry in there. And second of all, they say that Australians don't have a good enough understanding of ethnicity and what it is in order to answer the question. But in order to prove just how ridiculous and false that is, they're adding questions in about gender and sexual identities at the same time as they're taking questions about ethnic identity out. So you can choose to be transgender or you know, however many different identifiers they've got for the gender thing now, and you can choose what your sexual preferences are, and you can put all that into the census. But if you want to select your ethnic identity, you're not allowed to do that. And so their authentic ethnic identities are being taken away from us, or the ability to refer to ourselves using our authentic ethnic identities are being taken away. And we're being offered this array of sort of bizarre sexual and gender identities to pick from. Instead, it's almost like there's a plan to do like a bait and switch. offer us a bunch of fake and weird identities instead of the real thing, because they don't want, you know, the last thing that the people managing these countries and inflicting this policy of mass immigration and multiculturalism onto them want is for people to identify with their ethnicity and to oppose the mass immigration policy on the basis of it. I mean, this is linked to what we were just discussing with the ethnic erasure, getting rid of the term Anglo-Saxon in Nottingham University. And we've also seen very similar things happening with the New Zealand census. So the way Stats New Zealand is recording and presenting the ethnicity data in New Zealand makes it very difficult, if not impossible, to really figure out, you know, what proportion of the population is Maori, what proportion is sort of European descent, what proportion is Asian, and so on. And that's because where you've got these people who are ticking more than one ethnicity, so let's say I had some Maori ancestry, I could tick Maori ethnicity and European ethnicity. I don't, but just for example's sake, they're counting them twice in the data. And so the percentages in New Zealand add up to more than 100%. And so they're not presenting any mixed categories. So there's no way you can figure out from the information they're presenting to us what proportion of the population is Maori or European or whatever. And I think that's deliberate. I think they just don't want to. First of all, they want to cover up that there is a great replacement happening. And second of all, they want to delegitimize and eventually get rid of ethnic identifier terms altogether as Orwell told us, to make it impossible for people to even think in those terms. I think they want to do that to minimize ethnic conflict and also to prevent anyone from even knowing and objecting to what they're doing in terms of this mass immigration and multiculturalism policy.
It's interesting. One of the big interviews that blew up on X this week was one that Tucker Carlson did with Daryl Cooper. It's also known as Martyr Made. And he is basically a historian who does like 9-hour, 12-hour podcasts on specific historical topics. He actually raised some of this, speaking about the identity of Anglo-Saxons in England versus how, you know, the American identity changes over time, whereas obviously the Anglo-Saxons are just Anglo-Saxons and they've been like that for 1,000 years. But the core part of the interview that became the really controversial topic was his statement that he viewed Winston Churchill negatively, so almost as the villain of World War II. He said that effectively, and this is not a new subject, but I think for a lot of people who are listening who are upset about it, this was probably like news to them. But Patrick Buchanan, who I've referred to before, and the paleoconservatives in the United States have always viewed this to be the case, that Winston Churchill forced Europe into an unnecessary war, and that he refused to deal with Germany, refused to deal with Hitler at the time, and tried to work towards peace. And basically, all the atrocities that followed happened because you had these warmongers who, like Winston Churchill, who wanted to go to war. And that seems to have upset a lot of people. Perhaps you'd like to speak to it a little bit of kind of, I guess how the World War II narrative has shaped the modern world and the consensus and how it's sort of a part of history that people get very upset when it's discussed. Like, you can talk about any part of history, you can question different aspects of like every single part of history, but World War II, which happened 80 years ago, you know, it's like a sacred cow. Like, you know, people act like you've gone into their village and murdered their sacred cow.
Yeah, well, I watched that interview. I made a point of watching it. And I think it was a very important interview. So one of the things they talk about in there is how every society sort of has these founding myths by which they sort of organize their, you know, the values and the mores and the direction the society is going in. And I agree that in many ways, World War II in the post-war era, it's sort of become that. It's become like a sort of founding myth, and it's taken on this inviolability. You're not allowed to criticize it. You're not allowed to look into certain aspects. You certainly can't criticize the Holocaust, for example, or at least you haven't been able to for a long time, or raise any questions about that. The big thing that I think that came out of World War II was this idea that nationalism is bad and ethnic identity is bad, and that when as the person on that podcast, Marta Maid, said
his name is Daryl Cooper. I think if you
that's easy to say. We'll say Daryl. So, as he put it, the idea came about that anytime European people get together and organize on the basis of ethnicity, bad things happen. And so it seems as if ever since then, there's been this effort to prevent that happening and to break down European ethnic identity in order to prevent further wars and further conflict. And I'm just not sure it's more than not sure. I think that that is incorrect conclusions to have drawn from World War II. If you look back across the history of the world, like conflict is a normal part of human existence. And that's tragic. But to think that you can sort of redesign the world and get conflict out of it is utopian thinking. We need to be trying to minimize conflict for sure. But by engaging in this quest to try and get rid of ethnic identity, you've just sort of created a new conflict between ordinary people who take ethnic identity for granted, and it's sort of, you know, it's a normal part of their self-conception and everyday existence. And then this class of people who are trying to abolish ethnic identity. So you've created this sort of class conflict, and that's the dynamic we're living in now, where we've got a leadership caste in Western society who's basically waging a war of, it's not quite physical annihilation, but a spiritual annihilation, or it's hard to know what the right words for it.
Part of the accusation on the, one of the reasons why they I see an increasing negativity towards Churchill is to say, well, he won the war, he pushed everything through, you know, obviously a lot of negatives people will refer to from his actions during World War One as well, and other problems. So say he won the war, he pushed through, defeated Germany, no matter the cost, and it ended up costing, you know, the cost was the British Empire was gone, British society is broken down. Like you see today, you know, London is minority English in London and so on, and basically destroyed the English people as a result. So it's sort of like, well, was it really worth it? Was it the right thing to do? And that's why you see this increasing negativity towards Winston Churchill.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't want to comment too much. I'm not a historian, so I don't really feel qualified to comment on it. But I mean, I believe that we should be able to look into these questions and have rational discussions on it. And so I support it all from that point of view. And let the historians argue. We don't need to turn these things into...
We need to ban the historians. We need to complain every single time they propose a different view on history. That's what we need to do, William.
Yeah, well, I mean, how's that going to go? No, I mean, I think it's good and necessary to
certainly
look into these things. And one of the interesting things that Daryl said was that because there's been sort of a taboo around looking into certain aspects of World War II, there's incredibly fertile ground there for historians, once the taboo is lifted, for historians to go into what happened in World War II and what happened around the Holocaust and look at these things again and see if new information can be mined and new understandings or perspectives found there. And maybe they can be found there or maybe they won't be, but you won't know until you go in and look at it. And there's been a ban on basically looking at a lot of this stuff up until now. So we can't actually trust the mainstream contemporary version of history because there's all these taboos around questioning it. So it's sort of putting the taboos in place actually undermines trust in the accepted narrative, but doesn't actually defend it.
Well, I do have one last positive bit to come out of all of these stories on X, and that seems to be the focus of the international controversies at the moment. But we had potentially a diplomatic incident with Elon Musk commenting on one of Christopher Luxon's X posts. Christopher Luxon's social media team, I should probably say, posted a video of him in Malaysia, and he was speaking directly to camera, and then Elon commented on this saying, "I have to say, I really like the new New Zealand PM, the Prime Minister, good energy and talks directly to the public. This is the way." Obviously, Elon Musk is very happy to see world leaders use his platform and to be engaging with their voters and be engaging with users who are using the platform, especially since he faced the ban in Brazil that we've just spoken about. But I also think that he has a bit of a dig at Jacinda Ardern. I think that he specifically likes the new New Zealand Prime Minister because he didn't like the old one.
Well, fair enough. I mean, if someone wants to ban your platform, well, why would you like them? Jacinda Ardern is held up as this paragon, if that's the right word, paragon of this kind and empathetic leader who everyone loves and has brought us all together and made society, you know, like peaceful and cohesive. And the reverse is true. Like her image, the reverse of her image is true. She was, in many ways, authoritarian. She wanted to censor opinions that she disagreed with. She wanted to divide society. She took people's rights away during the pandemic. She created a two-tier society where if you did what she wanted and got the vaccine, got 500 shots of the vaccine, you could carry on as normal. But if you didn't want to do that, then you know you couldn't go out to the pub. You couldn't go to work in many cases, in many areas of work. You had to be vaccinated to get into the buildings. And you couldn't engage in society in a whole bunch of other ways. You became a second-class citizen. People didn't like that. She ruined a lot of lives. People came to Parliament. They protested against her. These are the people who, Jacinda Ardern is one of these people who upholds the right of peaceful protest. Yet when there was a peaceful protest against her, she didn't want a bar of it, and she treated those protesters like human garbage. So, I mean, she's a hypocrite, and she's the opposite of what she's portrayed as and what she portrays herself as. So we're all well within our rights to criticise her, and Elon Musk is certainly well within his rights to favour the new Prime Minister over her as well. So well done, Elon. And another good thing about this retweeting our Prime Minister's tweet is it's the New Zealand relevancy alert. You know, like, doesn't that make us feel good when, the world's richest man, the one with the biggest Twitter account, comes down from on high and does something to do with New Zealand, makes us feel important.
I definitely thought that when I saw, oh, well, that's great. Wow. And Elon Musk is commenting on New Zealand, you know, wow, suddenly I like Christopher Luxon more. That's just for a minute.
Yeah, well, what's that mean? What the hell? I love Luxon now.
Quickly, because we're running out of time, I'm going to do some local issues, going to try and quick fire through them. A number of them are related to sort of legal justice and security issues. So may as well. I think that's all we'll have time for anyway. So the first up, big news this week was Eli Goldberstein got a guilty verdict for assaulting a woman at the Posey Parker rally. Eli, people will remember, assaulting a woman. She assaulted Posey Parker by pouring the tomato juice over her. I think many people listening will remember that, if not everyone. Unfortunately, she was allowed to simply walk off. But I do believe there's another assault charge still to come, possibly against her or against someone else from the rally. I can't quite remember the full details on that. But when that comes up in court, we will definitely deal with it. He wasn't at all remorseful for what he did, and yet the judge was very lenient. And he said, I quote, only God can judge. End quote. So in response to that, I would say, yes, God will judge. That's most certainly going to happen. In response to, I think, the New Zealand judges, in some disturbing way, this is almost accurate, because the New Zealand judges tend to not judge at all. They tend to be terrible at it. And you can see that in this case, it was not a real judgment. It was simply, yes, guilty, off you go. There are no consequences for what you've done.
There does seem to be a tendency to let people off with lighter sentences if they're on this side of the political debate rather than on this side. And in this case, I mean, you kind of get the feeling that that's what's going on here as well. The thing with this one is it's wrong and it is assault, and there should have been some sort of punishment for what happened. But pouring tomato juice on someone, I mean, in the scale of assault, probably isn't that serious a thing. But in the context,
Justice should be at least, proportional. So you should at least have tomato juice poured over you by the judge in a... Maybe not.
My eye for an eye. You're an Old Testament man, dear.
I'm an Old Testament man. It doesn't have to be literal, you know, but that's the point, is the justice should be weighed in the scales. And the question that people are rightly asking is like, well, does this sort of weigh up because it was also political violence, which adds another dimension as well.
That was the bigger question. That was what I was going to go on to say, is that protest, that got well out of hand. So it wasn't just the tomato juice. The tomato juice throwing probably wasn't the major thing. It was the transgender protesters. They rushed the stage. There was violence. A granny got bashed. Posey Parker had to be escorted out of there by her bodyguards. The police didn't come. They called the police. They wanted the police to come and help them get out. The police didn't come. So she had to be got out of there by her bodyguards. And I've seen the footage of her leaving the arena. Like, they had to push their way through. And she was down in between those bodyguards, quite a small woman, no doubt feeling extremely intimidated in that situation. So that's the bigger thing, is that the New Zealand police did not do their job. They did not maintain peace. They did not maintain order. They allowed that violent situation to happen deliberately, because they refused to station enough officers in the correct place and use a force to hold back the trans protesters when it was necessary.
And we've had another report following up from the police report of racism in the police, one by the NZSIS this time, and this was around the issue of or risk of violence and terrorism in New Zealand. The full report is called New Zealand's Security Threat Environment, an assessment by the New Zealand Security Intelligence Services. And was there anything of interest to you that was mentioned in this report that the New Zealand Intelligence Services say that they're focused on or not focused on?
Yes, they say that the major threat, domestic terrorist threat in New Zealand, comes from white identity-based extremists. There's no evidence in the report that that really is the major thing. And the report says nothing about the fact that, woke ideology people inhabit all of the major institutions of our society and are systematically biased against the normal normal people, basically.
And as we've just discussed, have actually committed political violence and are currently going through the courts for the political violence that they've caused. Even previously, one was let off discharge without conviction. So these are the people who are committing political violence in this country, and there's not a single mention in the report.
That's right. And so this follows the trend of things that are happening in the US and the UK and elsewhere, of the police and the authorities are focusing all their attention on the traditional majority, the white majority in their country, and almost refusing to police the migrant populations that are being poured into the country by these people. So it's two-tier policing, in this case, two-tier intelligence gathering, two-tier security intelligence.
Yes, the report mentions in the issue of white identity motivated violence. They mentioned something called Terrorgram. I don't know, some kind of group. I'd never actually heard of it. I always thought Terrorgram was a joke, just a euphemism that leftists would use for Telegram. But apparently there's an actual thing called Terrorgram that they're worried about. And they mentioned ISIS as well at the end, just very briefly, but downplay it and say, well, there's nothing really happening here. Like you say, no evidence really provided for anything, except for, of course, those white people.
Yeah, and so it's in line with the basic tone of all their institutions against white people.
They do say at the beginning of the report, by the way, so that the report is not intended to single out any ethnic group.
Yeah, well, it would be racist if you singled out anyone.
Specifically mention it.
Right.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, and I mean, I remember this. I had had a little chat years ago now with the SIS, and they said to me, yes, we had been told by the government to investigate the right wing. That was the phraseology that they used. Well, we've been told to investigate the right wing. Of course, I said, well, you've come to the right place if you want to speak with the right wing. I'm right here. But just like that kind of insanity that you have a government saying, yes, you need to go and investigate the right wing. Or now it is, whatever it is now, white identity stuff. Like, yeah, there's still complete corruption of the SIS.
Yeah.
And then we've also got a similar law related issue back in the news. We spoke about this last week with the AUT changing their law curriculum to complain about colonization and the white oppressor settler colonial system. So this week they leaked a report of how much the law faculty enjoys working at this law school, where you've got members who are continually complaining about everything being racist. And the numbers are not very good, are they, William?
No, not very good satisfaction from staff working under Dean Kylie Quince at all. And one wonders if that has anything to do with the propaganda that she rolls out, with the teaching style. One wonders, I mean, this is a woman who is, if she is a woman, I'm not sure now, this is a person who was responsible for writing the police's systemic racism report. And also now she's teaching that there's a bi-jural legal system in New Zealand that's a sort of a hybrid of tikanga and the white colonial settler system. So she's campaigning for two systems of justice in both the police force and the justice system, right? So the systemic racism thing is a pretext for rolling out, you know, two standards of policing where you focus all your resources on the white people and you leave the minority people alone. And the legal system that she's teaching in her course is a similar thing in the legal system. It's about having different legal standards for Maori as opposed to other New Zealanders. So one wonders if she applies the same sorts of principles to her staff and her students. For example, is she grading everyone equally, or is she applying different grading standards to people based on their ethnicity? This is a legitimate question because she seems to believe in different standards of justice and of policing. And one wonders whether that approach has anything to do with the very poor satisfaction that her staff and also some of the students have.
Yes, the number who reported that they were happy with the senior leaders at AUT, so the number of AUT staff that are happy with the leadership, which includes Kylie Quince, was only 35%. Only 30% were comfortable reporting inappropriate behavior. Only 20% thought that innovation was recognized and rewarded. So if you do a good job as a staff, not a good chance that you'll get ahead. And only 5% thought that if someone was not delivering in their role, that AUT would actually do something about it. This is, I guess, in terms of clearing out incompetent staff, only 5% said that incompetent staff would be cleared out. It's been a long time since I've been at one of these universities. Well, I say a long time, just under 10 years. Probably not that long for most compared to most people. But something I would note is that, yeah, getting rid of incompetent people was always difficult. But the great institution I went to, the Manukau Institute of Technology, definitely did a better job than that. I think more than 5% of people would have said that they would get rid of incompetent people. Yeah, these are abysmal numbers of staff satisfaction at AUT. And 35% said that they had experienced bullying or harassment at work in the last 6 months. And 20% said they had been discriminated against. And of course, AUT being led by these anti-racist people, I'm sure that they were not discriminating against minority groups. So I'm not sure. I wonder if it's disgruntled European staff there at that 20%.
I would almost guarantee that that's what's happening.
And the AUT has also confirmed now, by the way, that Kylie Quince, the Dean of Law there, has no ongoing disciplinary matters. They have worked with her to help her ensure that she is safe and supported. And this is in the wake of her calling a senior King's Counsel a racist dinosaur, and that she hoped that all these people would go and die off in a corner. And this woman seems to have a lot of influence there. Even with the police, she has a lot of influence. She's friends with Andy Koster, who's the police commissioner, I believe. And she's bragged about getting the Police 10/7 show cancelled for being racist. And appears to have a lot of ongoing influence at very high levels within both the police and the judiciary in New Zealand, and obviously training the next generation of lawyers. So this is ongoing bad press for AUT, and I'm not sure if the government has anyone who is actually going to focus on fixing that.
Well, whose job would it be? Education minister.
Would it be education minister? This is where the funding comes from. Yeah, like no body has decided to get on the phone to AUT saying, "Hey, Your funding is, at risk because of the openly illegal behavior that your staff are engaging in.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe someone should get onto that. We'll see what the minister...
We'll have to put some pressure on the Minister of Education for that. And David, this was sort of supposed to be David Seymour's department, yet I haven't heard enough noise from him on that. So it might be good to do a follow-up with David Seymour and see what's going on there.
He's actually been quite good at following up on some of the stuff within the public sector, with push on public sector neutrality. So I think in principle, he would be fine with following up on this stuff as well. But it's just a matter of alerting him to it and putting a wee bit of pressure on.
Certainly the case. Well, that's basically it for this week. I think I did have one final question we can drop in here very quickly for you. There was a sudden death of the Maori king last week. We didn't really discuss that. And it's been a week now. They're having his funeral. It's still ongoing, I believe. And what were your views on, I guess, the Maori king and what the future of that particular office holds in New Zealand? I know that I should clarify for the audience, the Maori king has got a few tribes that recognize that institution, mostly in the Waikato. But it's got a very old history in New Zealand, going back to the 1860s, I believe. I'd like to do a deep dive on it in the future. I don't have space for that now. But a very interesting how it had its origins in a lot of old English traditions, and Christianity played a very big role in the sort of... the ideals that they put together when they put this Kingitanga together. But the current, or I say we should say previous monarch of this small little kingdom within New Zealand, he was actually, I think, very well respected by everyone from all sides of politics, was he not?
I think so. I'd like to express my sympathies to the family and the iwi and everyone involved. What I would note about the Maori King, I didn't follow closely. I have much to do with following the what was happening with him until the last year or so. But I think he behaved very responsibly in responding to the Maori protests against the coalition government. On the one hand, you had the Maori Party going away, organising a lot of these protests. At one point, the Maori Party were asking for a separate Maori parliament. And the Maori King counter-signaled that, which that sort of takes a lot of bravery on the part of a leader when your people are unhappy to counter-signal the more antagonistic forces in that way and to focus on unity. So he said, in response to the idea of a separate Maori parliament being formed, he said, "Are you guys sure? The idea frightens me." And so instead, what he focused on was this idea of kotahitanga. And in his speech at the National Unity Hui he called, he said that what Maori need to focus on doing is just being Maori. Be Maori all day, every day, right? So focus on building up your own identity, your own positive identity, and not necessarily on fighting with the government. And I just thought that was a responsible and statesmanlike thing to do and to say in the wake of these protests against the coalition government.
Well, thank you for that. And I think that's a great place to end this. And I'll just repeat for the listeners, if anyone's tuned in since the beginning, this is the last weekly roundup that's happening on a Friday afternoon because the dialogue will be shifting to Monday. And while there won't be a weekly roundup on this Monday show, we'll have a little bit of space to think about what we're doing with the segment. We'll probably do something very, very similar. It'll just be at the beginning of the week instead of at the end of the week. But we're working through those details. But do tune into the next one, which will be Monday, 2 weeks from now at, I believe, around 1 p.m. But stay, keep an eye on your inboxes in terms of what the new schedule will be at RCR, but some big changes happening. Thank you very much to William for joining me again. And it's been a pleasure as always. And to all of the listeners as well, do send us a text on 2057 or email inbox at realitycheck.radio if you enjoyed the segment, and we will deal with your feedback next time. Thank you, William.
Thanks, Dewa.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.